It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. During the last 16 months of economic challenges from the pandemic, people have struggled to pay for food as well as their rent. But water? The average Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority customer pays a small percentage of their income on those utilities, but in a third of city neighborhoods, at least one in five customers pay 10% or more on water and sewage. Public Sources' Oliver Morrison has been reporting on this, on how low-income communities can get assistance on these resources. Oliver, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Let's start, Oliver, with water bills. They've been going up in recent years across the country. What kind of increases have Pittsburghers been experiencing?
Across the country, the rates have been increasing about three times the rate of inflation, and in Pittsburgh, it's been about four times the rate of inflation. So they've really been going up a lot.
So how does this fit into EPA's recommendation, their standard, when they consider what is acceptable as far as a percentage of water costs compared to the individual's income?
They say that your water bill and your sewage bill together should not take up more than 4.5% of your income. And so we know, especially for people on fixed incomes, when those water bills have been going up faster than inflation, that for more and more people, and especially in Pittsburgh, these water bills are becoming unaffordable.
Mm-hmm. In your reporting, you used the Weatherspoon family in Pittsburgh as an example. What happened to them?
For them, paying the water bill becomes a challenge. So when the mother in that family, Elizabeth Weatherspoon, ran into some trouble and ended up in the hospital, she fell behind on her bill. She ended up calling up PWSA and said, "Hey, I'm having trouble paying my bill." And it turned out that she had been eligible this entire time for the last 4 years to be getting assistance. And she hadn't been because she just didn't know about the program.
As you alluded to, Oliver, PWSA offers some assistance programs to low-income residents, for example.
So one of their biggest programs is a discount program. So if you make 150% of the federal poverty level or less, and that sort of depends on what size family you are. For the Weatherspoon family, that's under $33,000 a year, and they were making, $18,000 a year, so they qualified. And so for them, they're going to get their 100% of their fixed cost on their bill is going to be free. And then that also includes their first 1,000 gallons of water. If they were an average customer, they end up using a little bit more than water than the average customer. But if they were an average customer, that would be about half of their bill they would be getting a discount on.
Do you have an idea about how many PWSA customers could be eligible for some assistance from the authority?
Yeah, so the PWSA looked into this in 2019 and did a study, and they found around 25,000 total customers are eligible in some way, shape, or form for this. And right now, they've only signed up just under 5,000. So they know that they have a lot of work to do. That's why they've hired a team of three people. They've taken on an advertising campaign. They've been promoting it on their website. They've been including flyers and food bank programs and things like that. On the other hand, when I looked at a study of national programs, PWSA is doing better than most of the programs of its kind. It gives more money and is more generous than most programs, and it signed up a greater percentage of people. But most of these water programs are not reaching low-income customers like they should be.
Hold it. They're doing better than most, even though they've only signed up like about a fifth of the people who are eligible?
It's kind of strange because you would think that a lot of these water utilities are public. Some of them are private, obviously, and so they would have the public good in mind. But the way I talked to an academic at Pitt who talked about how a lot of times, even though they're public utilities, because they like charge for a fee, they end up operating a lot of times like a private utility. And so her argument was that partly it was that due to public pressure that PWSA really adopted this program at all and has made it as generous as it could. So it's acting in the public interest more than some other utilities, but it's still not very good at all. Like they have more than $1.5 billion worth of projects that they have planned to fix the water and sewage infrastructure in the city. And that means that the rates are going to keep going up. Ed Gainey, the representative Ed Gainey, who was recently elected the Democratic mayoral candidate in Pittsburgh, he said that he's against raising the rates at all because he's worried about the impact that this is causing on low-income customers.
All right, so Ed Gainey opposes a rate increase. The rate increase is needed for the infrastructure upgrades, but does Ed Gainey, does current Mayor Bill Peduto, does the mayor of the city, whoever it is, have any authority to block it?
They do. There's a slightly more complicated answer than this, but the gist of it is that the mayor nominates the board members at PWSA who will serve on the board. And so in theory, if Ed Gainey wanted to, he hasn't said yet how he's going to appoint board members, but if he wanted to, he could appoint board members that are opposed to rate increases.
Back to outreach. You said that PWSA is starting to improve outreach efforts, but is it difficult to sign up?
Yeah, it can be a real challenge. I mean, even just like in researching it and trying to describe it, it is a challenge. Let me give you an example. If you're a customer in the South Hills of Pittsburgh, you have to sign up for an assistance program with PWSA on your sewer bill, but then you also have to sign up for a discount with Pennsylvania American Water, who provides your drinking water. And then you also have to sign up for another program with Alcazan, the Allegheny County Sanitary Authority, for your sewage treatment. So that's three different programs. Now, in theory, you should be able to sign up for all of them by calling the Dollar Energy Fund, which administers all the programs. But we know that that's not happening. So, for example, Alcazan, which has had their program around for longer than PWSA, has far fewer people signed up, even though they have more customers and a larger number of customers who are in poverty and should be eligible.
So for people who are thinking about, I wonder if I'm eligible, how can they find out if they are eligible for these programs?
So on Friday, we came out with an explainer that kind of walks people through like what they need to do to apply, what the income thresholds are, and what kind of documentation they will need. So for PWSA, for instance, all they need to do is say how much income they make. But for Alcazan, for example, they'll need to provide some sort of documentation to prove their income.
Oliver Morrison is a reporter at Public Source. Oliver, as always, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Carnegie Mellon University has been at the forefront of engineering robotics for decades, and now there's an effort underway to chronicle and archive that history. It's called the Robotics Project. Its first exhibit, Building the Robot Archive, is now available to view online. Here to tell us about this project is Catherine Barbera, lead archivist. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And also joining us is William Red Whitaker, roboticist, professor at CMU, and considered by many to be the father of robotics here. Red, welcome back to the program.
Pleased to be here.
Catherine, this is one of the first attempts to preserve a history of robotics. For a project like this, where do you even start?
It's hard to know where to begin when you're dealing with materials that have never been preserved at scale before. A question that people often ask about robotics is, what is a robot? And that's definitely something we are grappling with as part of this project. Something that we're going to be doing over the next 12 months is developing a collecting strategy with our team to determine, in our definition, what constitutes a robot, but then also how do you preserve its many complex multimodal pieces and parts.
Red, so what constitutes a robot?
Machines at work in the world. But I'm very broad in my view, honoring every element of such machines, meaning that there is so much actuation, computation, software, and that is the 45 years of evolution.
You've spent a career building robots. I mean, did you think that while you were doing the engineering, the building, that you were making history? Did you ever reflect on, take a moment in time to stop and think, we're making history here?
Certainly not in the early going. It's not the kind of thing that sinks in until, for me, a decade or so into it. In part, in the early going, it's so much about the doing. Of course, along the way, you get very, very clear that firsts are firsts. There's never a second chance to do something a first time.
Did you save all your prototypes, all of your notes, all your plans? Are you making it difficult for people like Catherine?
So one of the great challenges is that a great deal of the tangible aspects of that history have gone their way. Far, far too many of those robots are no longer with us. Many of the plans, codes, videos, rich as they aren't there. However, there are treasure troves of thousands of hours of great video from the day and tremendous body of publication print that is all of the technical content.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, what are some of the challenges of preserving the history of robotics? Is it just finding, locating, hoping that you have as much material as possible?
It is all of the above and more. As Red said, roboticists are tinkerers, right? They take things, they're engineers, they take things apart, they put them together. They take things apart, they put them together. A project might have 10 different iterations. Our challenge is recovering what we can and preserving what we can. Sometimes from a robot, we'll only have pieces and parts. So how do you reconstruct the story of that project from those pieces and parts, from oral history interviews with the team who worked on it, from all of the contextual materials that Red was talking about, the video, the code pieces that still exist? That is the challenge in front of us. And sometimes there isn't a lot of documentation left, which is why we are devising such a broad-ranging strategy in order to tackle this, is we're not just looking for the robots. We are looking for all of the contextual material, and we're going out and talking to the teams who worked on these groundbreaking initiatives so that we can get that first-person perspective.
Catherine, how do you decide, you know, what's important for the archive? What's not, or maybe less important, that maybe you don't even have room for?
We're taking the next year to really figure out answers to those questions. What are we going to preserve? How are we going to preserve it? But then also, what is our scope? Because we can't collect everything. That's just not a practical strategy. And one of the most important things we're doing as part of this process is going out and talking to the community to figure out from their perspective what is most important to preserve. But then related to that, what still exists? And then what is at risk within that category of what still exists? If there is a robot, a piece, or a prototype that is in an unstable environment or is going to be thrown away or is in a storage facility that it can no longer live in, our team will go in and recover those materials really before it is too late. Because when you're dealing with unique one-of-a-kind artifacts, there is no going back. Once you lose those materials, it's really difficult to recover that history.
Right. Will professors, will roboticists, will you just hold on to your work and keep your personal collections? How big is your personal collection?
Oh, it's vast. I get that. But I think we're missing it when we think about one person or a Red. It's vast because that reach of the real people, the scope of the body of work over deep time, just adds up. In the beginning, robotics was nothing but science fiction and fantasy. And there was grand vision to develop, secure, feed the world, explore worlds beyond, and no evidence whatever that of a technology or the evolution of a technology that would create that. It wasn't foreseen that it would turn into a discipline or an enterprise or transform things like farming and driving and exploration. So in that same way, there was never a sense that the time would come when history is a most relevant thing to capture. And except to do it at this time, there is the prospect of having missed so many of those pioneers, early practitioners. No one's forever.
Catherine, is it the robots? Is it the engineers? Who is it that's the real spark that brings this collection to life?
It is the community of people who work on these projects that make all of this possible. Part of our emphasis has been not just preserving the robots, the prototypes, the pieces, the artifactual evidence of this history. It's also talking to the people who make it possible, capturing their stories, capturing their experiences, capturing their insights into what makes robotics tick. That has become enormously important for us as researchers as we try to understand the development of the field and establish this archive. Because really, at the end of the day, that makes this history compelling. It's those stories, it's those experiences that people can relate to and help us as a community, as a society, understand the development of the technology.
Finally, people are used to interacting with history in a museum, but Catherine, you're planning to make this archive accessible online. Why?
So we are making it available online initially, digitally, because that is the best way for us to reach a broad audience. However, in the future, we do plan to present these materials as much as possible as part of in-person exhibitions and educational programming so that people can see and experience the history of robotics for themselves. Something that I have learned in talking with this community is that to understand kind of how a robot works is to actually see it for yourself. We do hope as this project continues to evolve over the next several years and beyond to be able to offer spaces for the public to come in and interact with this history.
And briefly, Catherine, it's a multi-year project. What's the next step?
Our next step after we finish this initial research is really implementation, is to begin collecting these artifacts, is to begin collecting oral histories at scale.
Red Whitaker is a roboticist and professor at CMU. Catherine Barbera is the lead archivist on the robotics project. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. As vaccinations have taken hold in Pittsburgh and around the country, in-person performances have returned to previously shuttered venues. More theaters have announced they will open this fall. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports on how a few are preparing.
On July 2nd, jazz funk trio Too Many Zoos played Mr. Smalls in Millvale. The former church is one of Pittsburgh's main independent music venues, and this was its first indoor show since the pandemic began 16 months earlier. The concert would have been hard to imagine just weeks earlier, when the state still limited the size of indoor gatherings. But those rules changed fast.
I was surprised that that happened as quickly as it did.
Mike Speranzo co-owns Mr. Smalls with his wife, Liz Berlin.
I underestimated the effect of the vaccine as far as what it would do to the spread and how it knocked it down so rapidly.
The show drew about 400 to see Too Many Zoos, who are based in New York and led by Pittsburgh native Leo Pellegrino on saxophone. But while COVID remains a real threat, only a handful of ticket holders wore face masks. Co-owner Berlin says the theater's rules are simple.
So basically the honor system, if you're not vaccinated, we request that you wear a mask and, you know, for your safety and everyone else's safety.
She adds the system is imperfect.
But there's really no way to police that.
Most local venues are taking a similar approach. Last winter, when vaccines were first being rolled out, even as COVID infections were peaking, some in the arts sector were talking about vaccine passports and other ways to screen audiences. Nowadays, with most venues either already operating or planning to reopen this fall, many are focused not on ensuring visitors are vaccinated, but on making their spaces more COVID safe. Mr. Smalls didn't have to do much. A consultant said they already had a good HVAC system, but other venues faced construction projects.
We've upgraded all of our systems throughout all of our facilities to be bringing in, first of all, more outside air, So we're bringing in at least 20% outside air into all of our facilities.
Scott Schiller is Vice President of Artistic Planning for the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, which operates multiple large performance spaces downtown, including the Benedum Center and Byam Theater.
Then we are using enhanced cleaning and filtration.
The Trust is planning to reopen its theaters starting in August. Over on the south side, City Theater expects to resume indoor shows in October. In preparation, it has torn up its lobby and box office. The renovation will remove a bottleneck of patrons that occurred because the box office was directly opposite the bathroom. The lobby has expanded into former office space, says artistic director Mark Masterson.
So you're not crowding in confined spaces when you come to the theater.
The theater has upgraded its HVAC system too. But like every venue, City Theater is watching as COVID variants spread and cases rise in pockets around the U.S. They know the rules for indoor gatherings could shift again.
As things change, we'll change with those changes, and we'll make whatever changes we need to make.
Most venues not already hosting live performances expect to be doing so no later than October. Yet even if audiences quickly return at full strength, the effects of the pandemic shutdown will linger. While nonprofits like City Theater have drawn on donations to survive, for-profit operations like Mr. Smalls have no revenue besides ticket sales and event rentals. Smalls was silent for more than a year. By September, the concert hall will have a full calendar again. But, says co-owner Mike Speranzo,
you could never undo the damage that COVID did.
Mr. Smalls benefited from various federal COVID relief programs. Some were grants or forgivable loans. One, however, was a disaster relief loan with a 30-year payback. Co-owner Liz Berlin.
You know, there's a lot more recovery ahead of us.
And because fall is the season when viruses typically flare up, all venues will face a lot more uncertainty as well. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.